Welcome back to this third segment of Samuel Adams Returns, The Anti-Federalist Got It Right. Thank you for joining us on Liberty Works Radio Network, where the voice of liberty and foundational truths ring loud across the nation. What is amazing to me is that this basic information about the very broad sense of the Reformation is never talked about in the Protestant circles. Like many of you, I'm on a learning curve that is so steep it seems like a mountain that is impossible to climb. Why do I say this? Well, think about it for a minute. We never really received all the facts and intent as to what our founders persisted should be the model education of the youth of these United States. We heard in the last segment what Samuel Adams defined as the purpose and means of education. During the break, Tom shared some interesting tidbits from the likes of John Witherspoon. Just a quick note on Witherspoon's background. He was the president of Princeton University, a key leader in the National Presbyterian Church of America, a member of the Continental Congress, and signer of the Declaration of Independence. It is said that he is a descendant of John Knox and was solid in his understanding of the historical Reformation and all its writers, as well as having a strong understanding of covenant in the arena of social compacts. With all that, he had this to say to an inquiring individual regarding education and the purpose of education. The concern you show on this subject is highly commendable, for there is no part of your duty as a Christian or a citizen which will be of greater service to the public or a source of greater comfort to yourself. He talks about how developing his thoughts on education was based on careful meditation and consideration that his words would be a great compass for the future. His first point on education is that husband and wife ought to be entirely one upon this subject, not only agreed as to the end, but as to the means to be used and the plan to be followed in order to attain it. Wow! Parents should be involved in how and what their children are educated in, and even more in what the outcome is to be. Wouldn't that be great if this was the general discussion at home instead of let the schools and the teachers plan our kids' life? Witherspoon puts the first priority of education in the spiritual arena in that the child should be supremely desirous in the understanding of God's providence, be an heirs of eternal life, and prepared to meet his Creator when demanded. Having these principles will be the most powerful of all incitements to duty, and at the same time a restraint upon that natural fondness and indulgence which, by the sort of fascination of fatality, make parents often do or permit what their judgment condemns, and then excuse themselves by saying there was no doubt it was wrong, but truly then cannot help it. There was a lot more that Tom shared, but you can sum up the rest of the purpose of education from the facts written by Adams, Witherspoon, and other founders as being the development of moral, virtuous, and politically astute children to preserve and carry on the foundational fundamentals of liberty, first and foremost. Then assist them in preparing for their own profession. We sure have it backwards today, and we actually have eliminated the first purpose of education. Well, let's get back to what Tom has for us regarding the background to the beliefs of the Anti-Federalist. Where are you taking us, Tom?
Kathy, thanks for bringing in that very quick summation of the thought process of our founders regarding education. What has always shaken me to the core is the reality that Christians left the national conversation in about 1830, whereas they led the conversation in the foundation of these United States. I know why they did, and when I learned that, I was disappointed, frustrated, and disgusted. But that's another topic for another time. Let's finish up with some additional points about Althusius. Many scholars will say that he was the first expounder on federalism. Quoting from another article written by Daniel Elazar, who, you must understand, has done a great amount of research and writing about America from the Jewish and Nation of Israel's perspective, he writes, Althusius himself was careful to acknowledge the first grand federalist design was that of the Bible, most particularly the Hebrew Scriptures or the Old Testament. For him, it also was the best, the ideal polity based on right principles. Biblical thought is federal from first to last. From God's covenant with Noah establishing the biblical equivalent of what philosophers were later to term natural law, which is Genesis chapter 9, to the Jews' reaffirmation of the Sinai covenant under the leadership of Ezra and Nehemiah, thereby adopting the Torah as the constitution of their second commonwealth, Ezra chapter 10 and Nehemiah chapter 8. The covenant, Latin for edus, from whence federal motif is central to the biblical worldview. the basis of all relationships, the mechanism for defining and allocating authority, and the foundation of the biblical political teaching. The biblical grand design for humankind is federal in three ways. One, it is based upon the work of covenants beginning with those between God and man, which weave the web of human, especially political, relationships in a federal way. This is through pact, association, and consent. In the 16th century, this worldview was created by the Reformed wing of the Protestantism as the federal theology from which Althusius, the Huguenots, the Scotch Covenanters, and the English and American Puritans developed political theories and principles of constitutional design. Two, the classical biblical commonwealth was a fully articulated federation of tribes instituted and reaffirmed by covenant to function under a common constitution and laws. Any and all constitutional changes in the Israelite polity were introduced through covenanting, and even after the introduction of the monarchy, the federal element was maintained until most of the tribal structures were destroyed by external forces. The biblical vision of the restored commonwealth in the Messianic era envisages the reconstruction of the tribal federation. Certain of the American Puritans and many Americans of the Revolutionary era, among others, were inspired by the biblical polity to seek federal arrangements for their polities. Number three, the biblical vision for the end days, the Messianic era, not only sees a restoration of Israel's tribal system, but what is, for all intent and purposes, a world confederation or league of nations, each preserving its own integrity while accepting a common divine covenant and constitutional order. This order will establish appropriate covenantal relationships for the entire world. Kant's and Buberg's grand designs draw heavily on that vision. In some respects, all subsequent Federalist grand designs until Proudhon in the mid-19th century are derived from or somehow related to that scriptural precedent. This is true, even though there were little distinctions between Jewish and Christian, Catholic and Protestant, and religious and secular grand designs within the biblical tradition. A grand design in this sense is a comprehensive proposal for developing the ideal polity that will function in harmony with the principal forces in the universe. It is meant to provide a basis for organizing all aspects of the polity and its social order in the manner of scriptural law and teaching. Moreover, it must be comprehensively federal. That is to say, every aspect of the polity is to be informed by federal principles and arrangements in a manner of the network of biblical covenants. Third, it should attempt to be realistic, that is to say, grounded in a realistic understanding of the human nature, its limits, and possibilities. The road to modern democracy began with the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century, particularly among those exponents of Reformation Protestantism, later rather mistakenly referred to as Calvinism, who developed the theology and politics that set the Western world back on a road to popular self-government, emphasizing liberty and equality. While the original founders and spokesmen for the Reformed Protestantism did much political writing, their writing was either theological or polemic in character. Only at the end of the first century of the Reformation did a political philosopher emerge out of the Reformation tradition who built a systematic political philosophy out of the Reformed experience by synthesizing the political experience of the Holy Roman Empire with the political ideas of the covenant theology of Reformed Protestantism. That man, Johannes Althusius, presented his political philosophy in that classical work, Politica, first published in 1603 and revised in final form in 1614. What does all this mean for us in the midst of the constant flow of federal departmental regulations, executive orders, congressional acceptance of international executive agreements, and imposition of foreign law into our system of justice that violates every foundational creed that you only have your American DNA to support your feelings of something is wrong? The reality is that Althusius and then Samuel Rutherford in Lex Rex write extensively about what is tyranny in a covenantal federal society or polity, as well as how to deal with that tyranny. The simple answer is to remove those that are usurpers of the people's authority, those that are tyrannical in violation of the covenant with the people, that being their constitutional relationship to us. Our friend Mr. Hall summarizes Rutherford in a way that relates to the present shenanigans which are happening in Washington, D.C. in real time. Quote, Rutherford maintained that the people create the king, notwithstanding true sovereignty belongs primarily to God, not the people. Upon the election of rulers, the people do not so much surrender the liberties and rights as delegated the authority to govern to the governor. Rutherford also recognized that people may resume their power at times, particularly if the king has become tyrannical. Rather than being above the law, the prince is under the law and subservient to the ends of the state. He is a servant or executor, hence executive power. Rutherford viewed civil governors not so much as dominating lords, but as ministerial fiduciary analogous to tutors, husbands, patrons, ministers, or fathers. Rutherford maintained that the law has a supremacy of constitution above the king, for a king is one not by nature, but only by virtue of constitution. Therefore, he must be king by a political constitution and law, and so the law in that consideration is above the king, because it is from a civil law that there is a king. The king is under the law in regard of some coercive limitation because there is no absolute power given him to do what he listeth as a man. We in America, we in these United States do not have a king, although this president is attempting to act like one. The Anti-Federalists, having studied all of these writers and more, understood and warned that if we the people did not recognize and maintain the principles of the five fundamental Reformation writers mentioned in segment one, the Constitution would and could become corrupted by designing people to institute a form of despotic tyranny by those that are elected into office. I submit the Anti-Federalists predicted correctly in that we have not maintained a moral and virtuous people such that we do not have moral and virtuous choices for elections. Yet we have the capacity to resolve our present situation. We have the historical writings of Theodore Beza, George Buchanan, Philippe du Plessis-Mornay, Johannes Althusius, and Samuel Rutherford, all put into the American context by our founders, especially voluminous writings of the Anti-Federalists. I will state unequivocally that for Congress not to put restrictions on the president by withholding the purse strings to various departments in the administration, as constitutionally allowed, is a violation of not only their oath of office, but a direct participation in the despotism and tyranny being perpetrated on the citizenry. Period. What can we do? We need to understand these foundational principles and remember what I began with regarding what the pro-Constitution crowd conceded at the time of ratification. Let me restate what I said in the first segment. Quote, to win the support of their opponents, the pro-ratificationists essentially had to consent to a doctrine of interpretation that must be considered a part of the Constitution, and that therefore must be the basis for interpretation today. This doctrine can be summed up by saying, quote, if a construction would have been objectionable to the Anti-Federalist, it should be initially presumed unconstitutional, end quote. with this. We have to get our feet on the street and talk with our neighbors. We have to ensure that they understand that they are the government and that only by being engaged at a grassroots level can we again return this nation to its foundational roots to preserve liberty and have true equity as we have discussed in today's program. Thanks for listening to Samuel Adams Returns, The Anti-Federalist Got It Right on Liberty Works Radio Network. Looking forward to having you join us again next week.